You're listening to a Guardian Live event. The Guardian has always been a community of readers, journalists, and contributors, and now our live events are bringing that community even closer.
The Guardian events are the Guardian at its best, which is a two-way conversation involving the reader and having a real, genuine, thriving debate.
Could be anything from food and culture, arts, to politics, to foreign affairs. Guardian members can attend from the very serious to the quite frivolous.
Support the Guardian's independent journalism and join the debates on the big issues of our time. To see what events are coming up and to check out the benefits of membership, go to members.theguardian.com.
The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Book Club. I'm Claire Armitstead, books editor of The Guardian and Observer. This month's guest is Karl Ove Knausgård, whose sixth-volume autobiographical novel My Struggle is travelling by slow boat into English, or so it seems to the many thousands of fans who have followed him avidly from early childhood through sexually frustrated teens. The fifth volume of this tremendous, maddening, addictive autobiographical epic, Some Rain Must Fall, has just arrived. It runs to nearly 700 pages and covers 14 years of his life, starting in his late teens, about which he disarmingly says he remembers surprisingly little. Since they were first published in his native Norway, the novels, if indeed they are novels, have gone on to win an international acclaim that their author has not always welcomed. Host John Mullen began this Guardian Live event by asking if he got any satisfaction from being praised.
Yes, I do.
Yes,
yeah, I do. But it's just like the image or the picture you get back from your work isn't matching my own view of it at all. You know, that's the hard part. You know,
but you must want readers, even academics, to relish and be absorbed by what you write. And as your alter ego says in the book, there are a lot of mediocre novelists. There are a lot of novelists, so by definition, a lot of them must be mediocre. So isn't there any satisfaction in having people telling you you're not one of them?
Yeah, but, you know, what I'm experiencing now with these books is, you know, is the dream for a novelist that people, when people talk about the books, they don't really talk about the books anymore, but their own lives, you know,
and that
kind of attention is the best thing for a writer. But it's hard to understand for me why that is. I mean, because for me, this project was the opposite. It was very private, very intimate, very, you know, very much about me. And I thought, this has no general interest at all. And when it gets that, I can't really understand why, and I just try to deny it and don't deal with it and don't think about it.
Well, that thing you said about people responding by, in some ways, thinking it might be a book about their lives as well as about yours, I mean, leads me really to where I wanted to start, really, which was, this was my rather dry academic version of that response, which is quite soon after I started the first volume, I started thinking, purely theoretically, how could I do a novel like this about my life? I'm not going to do one. I have absolutely no creative talent at all. I found that out a long time ago, and I'm reconciled to it. But because that was my way of thinking, how does one do a novel like this? And I suppose one very, to make it a much sort of simpler question, it's a version of thinking how much of this can be remembered and how much of it must be imagined, invented. And I guess that's a question that you've been asked before, but I suppose I don't know what the answer is, though I would quite like to ask it. There's such detailed and minute description of particular circumstantial details.
Yeah.
Particular episodes. Did you, as it were, have a sort of chain of events for this second volume, A Man in Love, that you were going to follow, and then, as it were, just sort of extrapolated, imagined the details to go with it, or what?
No. And the thing with this book is that there's hardly no narration, there's hardly no plotline, there's hardly no story at all, you know? And it is kind of experimental in that way, because how little, you know, story can you have and still read it, you know?
Yes.
In a diary, you can read immensely much without a story. And you can read about very boring things. I mean, before this project, I read a lot of diaries, and I was amazed by that. There's a Swedish playwright called Lars Norén. He wrote a 1,000 pages diary and published it. And it's like it's 50 pages about gardening. Mm-hmm. And it is about nothing, but you want to read more. What's that? Why? How come?
You know? Yes.
Is it possible to do that in a novel? Is it possible to tell a novel without a story and still have the drive in it, you know, like a narrative drive without the narration? That's that book.
Right.
The second book. And I didn't plan anything. So it's I write, you know, a scene, like in the beginning of the book, me and my wife with children, we are stuck in an industrial area looking for a place to eat, start to argue. No, that's the starting point. And I don't know anything about what's going to come.
Right.
And then it's the next thing that comes to mind, I write. So I don't know anything. So it's a pure intuitive thing, you know. So there and I didn't even plan that. That also just happened. You know?
But that was always the start. That episode, which to anybody with children has a ghastly familiarity, actually. Not that I have... Is it in Malmo? Is it in... I can't remember where it is.
It's in Sweden.
It's in Sweden, you know. But, I mean, I've had that experience in Basingstoke, as it were. I mean...
Yeah, and the strange thing, when I wrote it, for me, it was like a tragedy, you know. Yeah. It is a tragic situation.
Yeah.
And I thought of it as a tragedy when I wrote it, you know. But then I never read what I have been writing before. But then I got a Swedish translation, and I just checked and read, you know, the first couple of pages, and I realized, no, it's a comedy, you know. It is.
And I mean, before we lose it, I'm really interested about the idea of that you've thought about how you would do it. You thought about doing it after reading diaries, because in some ways, it's a sort of anti-novel, because it includes lots of things novels don't usually bother with.
Yeah.
Because they don't have enough meaning.
Yeah, that's right.
You know. Yeah. and actually, funnily enough, the diary I was thinking of, because I've probably read fewer diaries than you, but one of my favourite diaries is Pepys's diary. And he has the same thing that you managed to get of. You sort of don't know what is important and what is not. So there is a lot, for instance, which there is in your novel about food and eating. And
yeah.
I had 4 potatoes. And
yeah. But what I was looking for was presence, you know. That was the most important thing, presence in a situation, much more than narration. And to do that, I kind of described it in details, and it was like I wanted to. It's like the world was kind of disappearing for me. The world around me, and I was, you know, kind of almost living a life in images and, you know, visual things, and I was not present. And I wanted this book to be about being present, you know. So there's no arc going over. It's like here and now, and that's the structure throughout the whole book. I mean, when I'm 16, it's here and now, and when I'm 32, it's here and now, like in that book.
But when you do that, when you have that opening episode in A Man in Love, you probably have a very good memory, but you must have to, remembered that episode, you must then have to funnel in things which are completely invented.
All the small details, some of the small details are invented. But the room is how I remember it, and the situation is how I remember it. And there's nothing in that book I kind of remembered before I started to write.
Yeah.
So it's like it comes through the writing. And especially in the book about childhood, you know, I didn't have almost any real memories from my childhood.
Right.
I have like 10 or 15 or something. But if you start to write, it's like you, you know, one memory generates another, and it's like a, you're opening up.
So you do find, you did, as you were writing, find yourself not just inventing, but remembering what was
Yeah. And in book three, the childhood book is very physical. The key to remembering was through describing a physical world and a body and a bodily world, because that's the child's world, you know. And,
yeah.
And it's kind of, you know, it's like I have, that's my experience, that, that all the ages are still present, but they are not, you know, I don't have access to them normally. But through writing, you can get access to them, as you can through reading, you can get access to them. And maybe, you know, in psychoanalysis, you can also do that, but it is a process and it takes time. And but it is amazing. I know I have forgotten it, you know, but it's yes. there, and it's the process that made it there. It's the right.
Because that's a real paradox. Because you're the volume five which has only just appeared in English, you know, begins with a sort of paragraph about a long paragraph about not being able to remember things
That's how it is.
Yeah. And there's something also, I mean, but perhaps there's also, if you, this is my little sort of academic flourish, after which I won't try this anymore, but I'm very interested in 18th century novels. And funnily enough, although I suspect my colleagues are almost now, teaching Nausgaard as postmodern fiction, or perhaps post-postmodern fiction, the other thing it reminds me of a little bit is the very earliest novels, Daniel Defoe or something like that. The circumstantial, the importance of circumstantial detail. There's a bit where Thomas de Quincey, the opium man, says about some Daniel Defoe novel. He tells us that he turned left past the shop which belonged to a hosier who came from Worcester. And we ask ourselves, why on earth is he telling us this? And we think the only answer could be because it's true, you know. And there's that feeling, you know, there's a bit where Greer, your friend, is talking, and as he's talking, the narrator says, I picked up three potatoes and put them on my plate. And that makes everything else in the episode seem true.
Yeah.
But the okay, that's the starting place. You say it just sort of found you, but it does have the starting place, starting episode in A Man in Love. It does have an important narrative effect, even if it didn't have a narrative purpose, which is, of course, that a lot of the novel is about meeting Linda, falling in love, thinking about having children. And all that happens after we have seen you in Basingstoke, Malmo. Yeah. So that does, you must have known as you wrote that choosing that opening episode was going to sort of colour what came afterwards.
Yeah, what I knew was that was the subject I wanted to explore in a way, you know. But I had no idea what would follow, not at all. But this thing started out with a little tried to write about something very specific experience, which was my father's death. Which I couldn't write about as fiction. It didn't work, and I didn't believe in it. And somehow I started to write, and it took me 4 years with hard work, understanding that fiction didn't work. And then I started to write much more confessional, and that didn't work either. But then I kind of had this diary idea and this presence of a self, and that should be it, and dramatize that. And I started by accident writing about details, and it was a little episode about being 16 and so on and so on. And then all of a sudden it was a novel leading into my father's death. And then I just continued because I had a language for everyday life and a language for the things in between. The things that doesn't point in any direction, but just is, you know. That's presence again. And I wrote this book as a second part of that book. And then I was finished, then I was done, then I had 1,200 pages, and that was the novel. And that was death and love, and a very simple structure, trying to see that, you know, sea of details and everyday life, which is my life, where I felt it's meaningless. Somehow, I couldn't find meaning in it. But I remember when my father died, it was kind of so much meaning there in so little space. It was very intense and very strange. And I always wanted to write about that. And it's the same falling in love with the same intensity. And so that's the basic structure. That's my only thinking in the book. The rest is just intuition and try to, you know, follow the impulses and...
I mean, the you're talking about that being the only structure in the first book in the series, A Death in the Family, as it's called in English. There are two sections in the novel, yeah. And there is a break, and to the first time reader, the break seems quite a significant moment, and it's quite soon after. The recollection of finding out that your mother and father were going to separate. In the second volume, and I think the others as well, there are no section breaks at all. And so your experience of, you say, not knowing where you were going, you make that the reader's experience as well, in a way. And that must be, I mean, were you tempted ever to sort of have chapters or to break up, to fragment the narrative so that a reader had signposts and stopping places? And
no, I wanted exactly the opposite. I wanted the flow, you know, like something is just moving, you know, and it can go there and it can go there and it's like it's floating. And a style like that, I had a kind of an image of that, and I've had that for many, many years. So in my first novel, which is a very realistic novel, and it's a very strong narrative, then I kind of had expansion to the side, like anecdotes, and I thought, how far can you go before that's a new story, and you lose track of the first one, you know? And I could 30 pages... If the story is strong enough, yes, maybe even 40, but that's it, you know. And in this book, I wanted only have, you know, digressions, like something, much more like that. And it was so experimental for me because I knew how difficult and dangerous that is. Realism, if you try to describe something very, very, you know, in detail, it becomes very boring, and there's nothing there, you know. It's like it's just spreading out. So how far can you go before you lose interest, you lose meaning, you know? But I think that was a strange experience with that. It's like going, opening the refrigerator, seeing what's there, shutting it. That's a little story, you know. That can keep the interest, and I don't know why, but it's. I never suspected that. I thought this book is unreadable.
No, really, but it's the opposite. It's completely addictive. I mean, that's the word people use most often. Sometimes almost resentfully. I've heard people say, oh, God, you've got to keep... You know, as if they feel they've been sort of hooked to something unwillingly.
Yeah, that is very interesting. It's I've just read... War and Peace by Tolstoy for the second time, and it's one of the, you know, the best novel ever, and I was completely absorbed in it, and it's got the storyline, all the stories. It's such a perfect novel, you know, and it's a wonderful experience. And then I read Turgenev, A Hunter's Sketchbook, which is no narration, and it's only sketches, and he only, you know, write about a little bit about nature, then people he meets, and it feels so authentic. It's like you could see Russia 1840 you know, like being there. You don't have that feeling in Tolstoy. Tolstoy has a lot more general thing going on, but that experience there is very strange, and it should be boring, but it isn't. You know? Well, and that's again, it's presence. It's kind of evoking presence that makes, that's the thing.
So, but there is something, I think, for me, there's something slightly unsettling about it, but the simple fact that all the volumes are quite long books, and perhaps part of the feeling of being addicted is you don't know where you can stop. You don't know where you can stop. Well, there are, very charitably, every few pages, but irregularly, you don't know when they're going to come. There are little white spaces.
Yeah.
And I call me conventional. If I needed to stop, and you do need to stop sometimes, I mean, there's a bit where Carl Ove, where you're narrating, you say, oh, I had nothing to do, so I sat down and read the first volume of The Brothers Karamazov. So there are little, but actually it is difficult to know, and you're used to reading novels. One is used to reading novels which say, you know, now you can go to sleep, you can switch the light off. This is you know. So that sense of, you did completely get that sense for the reader too, of being in a flow which is undifferentiated somehow.
Yeah, and then there is like a form, a novelistic form, that shape. It says something, it isn't neutral. It says something about, you know, a view of life. And I wanted this book to be as close to life as possible, and life is constantly moving, constantly changing. It's nothing that is still, you know, but a form is standing completely still. So a novelistic form could be, you know, in touch with life a little while, and then life will continue and a form will be there, you know. So it's impossible to write, for instance, Madame Bovary again in that form. You have to change it. And that I tried to do in that book, kind of not to use that form, because I wanted to get closer to something. Mm. But then again, in 2 years, then this will be a form, and it will be dead, and life will continue.
I'm sure there are people hammering away in a sort of a sub-Nausgaard, trying to do it even now. Perhaps I'm wrong about this, but I detect a slight difference between the first and the second books in the series, in that much more in the first one, you even do what you've just described in paragraphs. You know, I used to sort of have with students a kind of quiz, you know, which novelists write the longest paragraphs, you know, Henry James, George Eliot, Franz Kafka, and they would always think it was the longest novels, but no, you know, Kafka's paragraphs, little books and paragraphs going on and on and on and on. But sometimes in the first book, there are paragraphs which go on for 3, 4, 5 pages with not a break. So the reader is almost, you feel challenged. I mean, you're going to have to read all of this. You can't go and have a cup of tea or go to the lavatory. You've got to read all of this. So that was that too, a conscious. You do it in the second book too, but much less often, I think. That was a...
No, it's not like I took a decision to have long paragraphs. It's much more... I've said this 10 times now, but it's intuition, it's rhythm, it's movement, you know, and... And again, when I was a kid and went to school, we were taught in Norwegian then that short paragraphs was the best.
Yes.
It was effective, and that's the way you should write, you know. All other writings were, you know, bureaucracy writing or whatever. And Norwegian is a very sparse language compared to English, for instance. It's very much based upon short sentences, few words, you know. And then in 1995, Marcel Proust was translated to Norwegian for the first time. And it is a translation that's true to the French very much. And it was such an eye-opener for me, because it changed somehow the Norwegian language, the possibilities. And there's so many long sentences, you know. And you have that movement. And when I saw that, I didn't know of it. I read Proust. I couldn't write. I hadn't been able to write for 5 years. I read Proust. 2 years later, my first novel came out. And I had no idea that there was a connection, you know. When I see it now, it is, you know, I've just taken it and used it to my own purposes. Right. But and then since then I don't think about writing at all in those terms. It is like playing music or something. It is, I mean, the form and the movement and the way it is intuition, and I can't explain it.
I can imagine it's not premeditated, but that it's very powerfully part of the experience of reading. And I just remember one piece quite relatively early in A Man in Love. There is a passage about your uncle Kjartan. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yes.
And it is a digression in a way. He doesn't come back in that book. And he is an unusual, interesting, eccentric character. And I can't remember, you might be able to remember, I can't remember how he comes in, why he gets mentioned. But once he's mentioned, he needs his space. That's what it feels like.
Yeah.
And he gets a 6-page paragraph.
Yeah.
And I think of that as Uncle Kjartan's paragraph, you know. And it would almost, I'm sure you didn't think of it like this, but very, you know, it feels like if you had a paragraph break, that would not be true to... But he has his column of prose.
Yeah. I've never thought of it like that. But it's true. For me, a novel is a way of, you know, building a room or building a place where it's possible to say the simplest of truth, you know. But you say it, if you just say it, it's banal and it doesn't mean anything. So you have to create a room for it to be said and to be true and to be meaningful. So there is that's one of the major thing with a novel too, is that it is a room where it's possible to say something, basically very simple things, and whenever you introduce a character, he needs room, he needs space, you know, and that was the same with my father's death. It needed space. It needed 100 pages with, you know, being 16 first, and then that was possible. And when I was writing it, I. The book two is called A Man in Love. In no way it's only called My Struggle Two. It has
right.
no title.
No title.
But it is a book about love. But when I delivered to my editor, the love story wasn't in it. It was only kind of the dark side of marriage and of, you know, relationship, and there was no light in it. And I realized that isn't fair, that isn't right. I need light. I need a love story. And then I had 2 days. That was 2 days before for the deadline. So I thought, so I sat down and I wrote for 24 hours nonstop, 50 pages, which goes straightly into the book. And the whole point with us is if you write very, very quickly and do it for, you know, hour after hour after hour, if you do that and you write about love and light, and it's kind of everything changed into some ecstatic thing, you know, it's like it's taking over, and it's very simple and very banal, but it still has this energy, and then the book was finished, then it was done,
and that wasn't rewritten at all. That was just that just went in.
Yeah, and it's the same thing. It is, you know, the book lacks something. You put it in, and it is. But you don't. It's not. It's impossible to construct. That's my point. And the ecstasy. I only could call that in such a situation where it is. I can't avoid it. I have to write it exactly as it is. I don't have time to do anything else. I have just to do this, you know. So that was a very intense experience. And I know I could never write like that again. You know, it's impossible. It was exactly that situation that demanded it. And that's how these books are made.
Ah. I mean, so certainly you talk about that, the ecstasy of love. And you've talked about the writing about your father's death in the first book. Of Of course, I mean, the extraordinary thing is, I mean, everybody remembers and is gripped by those passages. But also, when you listen, I don't know you, if you listen, you perhaps don't like to listen about people talking about your book so much. But when I listen, what I hear often people saying is things like, "Oh, the children's party."
Yeah.
"Oh, the children's party, my God. I've been to a few of those, you know. Why has nobody done that before? Changing the nappy." You know, I mean, it's not so long as the children's party is quite long. Yeah. I know, 40 pages or something.
Oh, is this that long? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Perhaps the party seemed even longer than the 40 pages at the time. But you, I mean, that is... Was it completely instinctual to devote that much attention to, you know, not love and death, but a children's party?
I had a feeling when I, you know, started to write these books, that there was something unexplored in that area, you know? Like there was something... Women have written about it, but I don't know any men who have written so much about, you know, raising children and all those things. Mm. So I thought that made it like I was exploring something when I was writing. Like, this is a new thing, you know, even though it's so boring and so everybody knows about it, but still to make it into writing made it exciting somehow.
It's completely gripping, the children's party, to the reader too.
Yeah, and I don't know why I wrote about that, because it was so terrible to be there.
Yeah.
It should be even more terrible to why I write about it. But there is something there, you know, and especially my daughter, she's so visible there, and that's the touching thing for me was when I was carrying her away from there, and you have this shoes and all, and and that was the moment I wanted to get to, you know, and I had to go through that party, and so to represent that emotion of, you know, instant love, I wanted to take care of you, and, you know, let's get out of here, and let's, you know, that feeling, and then I had to go through those terrible, terrible things, and then there is, of course, a kind of mocking of Sweden in it too, which is fun for me,
because
I come from Norway. There is a bit difference, I mean, where they have the vegetable and dips, and that was it, you know. No sugar and a chilling party. That's those kind of things.
The foreignness of the situation is quite an important thing in A Man in Love as well, isn't it? The fact that of being in Sweden.
Yeah, that is very important. And it's like I came from Norway and I went to Sweden and I didn't know anyone. I started completely, you know, blank. And that's a very good starting point for a novel too.
Yeah.
So everybody I meet for the first time, and you're building up a life slowly, and you can see everything very clearly because, you know, there is everything is for the first time. And there is also very interesting, it's a kind of a miniature exile, you know, slightly little exile. There was something going on around me. I didn't know what it was, but I could feel it. I could feel, you know, it felt bad. But I didn't know, I have to try to identify what I'm doing wrong, you know. That's a cultural thing, and that's common for, you know, everybody. And it's so interesting in Norway, Sweden, because it's so little, the differences between the countries. And that is also kind of fueling that novel, try to understand and to see cultural differences, because so much of my identity I discovered is being a Norwegian, not like a nationalist, but just that's the culture you have, that's the thing you have inside of you, and then you're confronted with something different, other values, you know, and you can see the values. Oh, this is a value, you know, that's what it is, and it is, you can change it. I thought this is how things are, but it isn't. It could also be different. So I discovered this very late in life, but I was like 33 when I was there.
And that, I mean, thinking about those experiences that you've turned into narrative, like the children's party or whatever, there is a sense, you say you're surprised that it's enjoyable to read and interesting to read. But there is, and even though sometimes there's the sense that you're almost making the reader experience it as the amount of detail you give.
Yeah.
It's as if we're going through it. I mean, there's a famous, there's a famous example of that. The children's party is funny as well, but there's a famous not funny example of that in the first book, which is when you have to clean up the house that your father, your grandmother's house, isn't it, that your father's been in. And you go into minute detail about cleaning the bathroom, the lavatories, and more than one person has, a reviewer that I read, said, it's like you are there, you're on your knees too, and you'll tell exactly what kinds of unguent you use and the colour of the stains and how long you have to scrub for. And it is as if we're going through it too.
Yeah, that was, you know, that's the best thing you can say, because that's what I wanted the book to be, you know. That was why it was so difficult for me to write about death, because I couldn't represent my experience. I had to find a way to represent it so that it can make a presence, so you could feel it, you know, so you can have the feeling of being there. And I think when I started to write, I was 18, and I was completely ignorant. I didn't know anything. And I started at a writing course. And I remember I read Milan Kundera and Knut Thompson at the same time. Knut Thompson with Hunger. I don't know if you're familiar with it or have read it.
I haven't read it.
It's just all about being there. It's all about presence. It's one person and his hunger and try to get food, and that's it. The only narrative drive in it is hunger. I need to get something to eat. And it's, you know, down on the street. It's very physical. And then at the same time, I read Milan Kundera, his novels, and it's kind of much more postmodern, elegant.
Yeah.
He comments on his characters, move them a little bit, you know. And I thought then, I don't want to do that. I want the presence. I want, you know, that kind of novel that makes you feel that you are there. And I didn't think, you know, how to do it, but it has been there ever since. That's what I want, you know. And all my writing has kind of tried to get to those places.
I must give everybody here a chance to ask questions in a second, but I can't go through my bit of the event without asking you. Well, comes from examples like that of Uncle Kjartan, which is what you do with real people in the novels, and in this one, A Man in Love. I mean, I've read somewhere, I don't know if it's true, that Linda read the manuscript before you published it.
Yeah, of course she did.
Yeah. And she thought she didn't want you to change anything, or...
Yeah, it was one thing. I have written that she whipped horses or donkeys at the opening of the book, which she said, I didn't. Where did you take that from? That's the only thing she wanted to take out. She didn't.
No donkey whipping.
No. But the rest, she said, it was fine.
Fine.
Ah. No, but the thing is that she's a novelist herself.
Right.
She's a writer herself. And I told her that I'm writing this book, and she said, then you have to go all the way. Please don't make me a bore, was what she said. Because, you know, if you hold back and make restrictions, the life disappears, you know, so you have to go all the way. But when she read it, she was...
you have made her fascinating. You've made her really fascinating and bewitching. You haven't made her... But I wonder if your partner hadn't been a writer, if they would have been so fearless about allowing that. I mean, it's a...
I think that was very, very hard. But it wasn't as much as other people should read it and see it. It was much more that I revealed thing in the book that we haven't discussed. That was kind of new to us.
Yeah.
And in a relationship, it's based upon, you know, there are certain things you can say and certain things you don't say, and you know of them, but it's not there. And I wrote it and put it all there. And that was very hard to, you know, to deal with and to... Then I think her answer to this is that she felt that the language kind of took care of her.
Mm.
And she said, if this had been a bad novel, it would be terrible, terrible. But she think it is good, you know. So,
It wasn't fun to write about.
Well, and what about, I mean, what about other people? Because presumably every character in the novel, including the Russian, the terrifying Russian, is a real person.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Did you change names of people?
I changed my family's name. I don't mention... they have different first names, and I changed where they live and so on.
Right.
But, you know, there's only one family in Norway called Knausgård, so that was completely useless.
Yeah.
But we did it for legal reasons.
Yeah.
And there are some other people that are maybe three or four that changed names.
Right.
But the rest is authentic, it's them.
But you didn't ask anybody else what they thought about being
I sent my manuscript out to everybody.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, before. Yeah, I had to do that. And that's one of the rules in the book for me is that I had to be able to watch that person in the eye afterwards. And I had to do that.
But that's quite a lot of people, isn't it?
Yeah, no, not the one I just mentioned, but all the major characters, you know, like my family and like Linda and like my friends.
The friends, yeah.
Yeah, so they read it all. And some of them, and they could take out things if they liked. Nobody did.
Nobody did?
Yeah, but they did some things, you know. There was one person attempt suicide and the family didn't know, so then I took that up.
Okay.
Those kind of things are not in the book, but the rest is.
Because your mother-in-law, you sent her.
That's I did, and I sent it to the wrong address, and there was a deadline here, you know. Then I sent a new one, so she had like 2 days to read it, and she's old. And she said, I trust you, it's okay. I don't have to read it. And I said, okay, that's good. And I was relieved, you know. And because she is kind of the person who gets the toughest treatment in the book.
Yeah.
And then the book came out. That was okay. But then the book came in Swedish. Then a friend started to read it. And she read it. And she was very, very angry. And I was writing, you know, the other books, and we needed someone to take care of the children, to help, and she was there, and I was writing, and she was there, and she was angry, and I tried to, you know, try to avoid talking about this, and but she was very generous, and she allowed it. It's okay, but I'm angry at you, you know. And she doesn't want, you know, the grandchildren to read about, you know, the alcoholic things and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But everybody in the book that have written about is getting used to it, and it's okay. And it's not dangerous, I hope, and I think. But when the book was published, I couldn't know. That was a dangerous thing. I mean, if people had breakdowns or if they, you know, would kill themselves or whatever because of what's there. I mean, you couldn't tell. So it felt very, very risky and dangerous doing this. And I was, you know, constantly afraid, full of fear, nonstop every day. And everybody was angry and was so, you know. And then I was writing the other books. It was very intense, I have to say.
Huh.
But people... Almost everybody has been extremely generous with allowing me. And now I have a friend who is writing about me, and I know how... Oh, I can't say anything about it, you know, but I know how unpleasant it is. And it isn't just that you are, you know, saying something that you don't want anybody to hear. It's like they're taking something from you, make it into... I take something from you and use it to my own purpose, you know. And you're just taking something away from, and that's it, and that's not a good thing. But all novelists do. I mean, all novelists do.
But it's incredible. Maybe it's the sort of the intensity with which and openness with which you do it somehow makes it easier for other people, because there are so many cases, you know, in the history of novels and novelists, where people have been very, very upset about being used or appearing.
Yeah.
But almost always they have appeared in a supposedly hidden form.
Yeah.
And maybe if you're not in a hidden form, it's it's less difficult.
Yeah, maybe. And I think my experience with this is the worst thing is to be reduced. Reduction is, yes, the worst thing, you know. That was what my mother said. It's so hard to be reduced, you know, to this little thing.
Yes.
So the rule is, the more you write about someone, the bigger place they take, then better. Even if it's, you know, bad things going on. If it's a lot, it's much easier to relate to somehow. Wow. So yeah, my mother wasn't happy with that, and yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Well, it's extraordinary. But I think I want to give everybody here, or some of the people here, a chance to ask questions.
Yeah.
So I think we've got some roving microphones. We've got some hands up. I'm quite dazzled, so I hope the people with the microphones will help me identify.
I've read all four books. Just I've gorged on them in the last 4 weeks, so I feel I know you ridiculously. You just talked about your mother, and it's your mother I would love to hear more about. What do you talk to your mother about now? Because your mother is almost the most shadowy figure in the book, I felt. What do you talk to your mother about? And as a separate question, what music do you listen to now? Because I really liked your musical taste all the way through. So what do you listen to now?
So you ask about what I'm talking
to your mother about?
To your now?
Yeah, and what do you listen to musically?
Yeah.
And if you can connect those questions. Two,
yeah,
even better.
Yeah, but it is interesting because I found it so hard to write about my mother. It was so difficult. It was so difficult to hear her, to find her voice, and to make her present, you know. And she has quite a small role in the book comparing to my father and the others. And one thing is that she's still alive, but the most important thing, I think, she was giving me things, you know. She wasn't taking away anything, and it's very hard to see the people who gave you something and to know what they are giving. So I had really problems with, I couldn't really even remember what she was doing when I was growing up, you know. I just know that she was there and she was good, but I couldn't recollect anything really. But I had been talking with her throughout my life. Also when I was writing these books, so she said, you have to stop, think of your children. She could call me, Norm, you must stop now. It's enough. It's good enough. Stop, you know. And she wasn't concerned about herself. She was concerned about me and my children. And I still talk with her, you know. And I don't really know what we're talking about, you know. It's, you know, all kind of things. Music. You asked what I'm listening to. Yeah. I get up at 4 every morning and I put on one record and then another record, and it's the same records and it's been for a year, and I don't know why. They're not specifically like I want to recommend them, but that's what I'm listening to. So the first is War on Drugs, the latest album, and the second one is a band called The Lines, a kind of country American-ish band, and then I like Midlake, Iron and Wine. So it's very calm music these days, like calm and simple music.
It's funny, the lady says she likes your musical taste. The thing I remember is you're saying, and I put on some Coldplay as I was driving. I hate Coldplay,
yeah,
but it's brilliant for driving.
Yeah.
could I ask you about the very provocative title, My Struggle, Mein Kampf?
Yeah.
As a German historian, I had real difficulty starting your books, which I loved. Was this the publisher who asked you to use this title? Or
No.
Was it yours? And why? No. And were you aware? Did you want to provoke people with this title?
Yeah, it had another title in the beginning, kind of a working title, which was Argentina. Which doesn't say anything. And I was talking with my friend, and we were discussing Adolf Hitler and Mein Kampf. And I mentioned the word Mein Kampf, and he said, there's your title. And I knew instantly that he was right, because this is a perfect description of the book. It is my struggle. It is a struggle. And it is a very small struggle. It's a struggle, everyday life struggle. And I love the title because it's such an ironic title, because when you know of the other my struggle, you know, which is the big struggle, which is completely different. Being an intuitive writer, I knew, the only thing I knew when I called the book My Struggle was that I had to read Hitler's My Struggle, since I chose the title. And yes, it was a provocation too. It was a way of saying, you know, fuck you, I don't care about you, I just do it this anyway, you know. That's also in the title. But then I had to read Mein Kampf. Have you read Mein Kampf by Hitler? Yeah. Yeah, and I did read it, and I realized I have to write about it, and I thought I should just, you know, write a little bit about it, and then I ended up writing 400 pages about Hitler's way to writing My Struggle. So the thing is, who was the man who wrote My Struggle? And it's the only place in the book where I don't write about myself, and it's kind of, I just ended up there by choosing that title intuitively in the beginning, and it makes complete sense in the book somehow. You know, Hitler starts the book writing about his father and his mother, and it's a representation of himself. That's, you know, terribly interesting. And he hadn't done anything. He was not very old when he wrote it, so that was why I picked the title, and that was what happened with the title.
Okay, up in the balcony.
Hello. Hi. I guess what struck me about the book is that there's a kind of incongruity about the self-conscious kind of now scarred at the children's party that you kind of described earlier, and then the person that's so kind of hugely revealing about who they are. And I just wondered, since you'd written it, if you'd ever regretted what you'd done. It's kind of that self-consciousness versus like the incredible openness of what you've done, and if you'd sort of thought, God, I wish I hadn't done that.
Yeah. It was difficult in the beginning. It was like a threshold I had to cross, and it was hard, but it became easier and easier during the writing. And I don't care about myself in this. I mean, I can't do that. I have to write novels, and they are existing in the world, you know. I can't think of me. I have to think about the novel. Is it a good novel? Is it a bad novel? I want it to be a good novel. And if it takes that to tell everything, you know, most embarrassing thing, then I'll put it in the book, because I don't care that much for myself. I care much more for writing novels, to be honest. So if I could cut off my left arm, I would have done it if it ended up in a novel. So I don't regret anything about what I've been writing about myself. I do have some regrets of what I've been writing about others. I do have, yeah.
Yes, please.
I found your novels very hard, and I found your first one because of the timing of it. So although it was addictive to some, I found I read it over a very long period of time because my father was dying, and he'd come to stay with me, and I had this death in the family. He actually picked it up and dropped it on the floor. He was so shocked by the title, and I remember reading the beginning chapter and the beginning part, and the way it goes very sensorially into the, you know, the deaths in the street, and, you know, if everyone was laid there, and I thought, shit, I can't read this. This is too intense. And then later on, when he did die, I took it with me. You know, it's like an open wound. I just had to keep going back there. You made me laugh, and I, you know, 45 page, you know, a few pages in, I start to really get engrossed. But I was traveling with you, and it took me a year before I sort of finished it. And books that have done that to me before, Nabokov and Proust, or people that make you cry at that moment of kind of release. I just, from that point, I wanted to ask you, you know, this intoxication, this state you have to get into to write. And your father as a catalyst, as that moment when you looked for a truth, this rawness, this honesty. I mean, that's where you can write about anything, like you said, when it's truthful, it's vibrant, it's alive. And with grief, there is that rawness, you know, that rudeness you almost have with people who speak trivia. And do you always find that place? It sounds like you need to dig up every time, not necessarily bones of the past in that way, with love or with anything, this brutality, this sense of going into the wound to express, and from there everything comes. Is that how you find it as an experience? Because I certainly did.
Yes, I think when my first novel came out, it took me 5 years until the next novel, and then 5 years again. And in that time, when I tried to write, it was those places I was looking for, you know, a place which is about life and death. Somehow, it hasn't been need to be directly so, but somehow that is what I'm looking for. And it's very hard to find, I think, because I don't want to publish anything that is, you know, fake for me, or that it is just, you know, something I construct. I don't want to do that. And when I was writing in my 20s, it didn't come from the inside. It was like I was constructing something on the outside, and it could be good, and, you know, but it didn't really matter to me, and it has to do that. So now I'm at the same place. You know, I'm writing, but it isn't burning. It has to be burning, you know, and it makes my life maybe unnecessarily hard, but then it's, why bother if it's not very, very, very important? I mean, yeah.
Oh, hi. I was quite interested in the idea of shame, and I remember reading once that you said that writing is a way of getting rid of shame. And I'm quite interested in the idea of shame, and in the relationship with your father, it seems there's a lot of shame in that relationship and kind of humiliation, or that's the way I read it. But could you talk a bit about the idea of shame and writing, and whether you still have a lot of that inside you?
That shame is basically a good thing. I mean, it's a way you be regulated to be, you know, in a social context, which is good. So you behave and you do what you should in a social context. But then you could have, you know, overloads of it, which I had. I was ashamed of really nothing. My father made me ashamed of things, for instance, and kind of broke my self-confidence completely. So when I wrote my first book, I just wrote a novel, and then my editor said on the back of the book, you know, this is a monument of male shame. And I didn't know that I'd been writing about shame. I wrote about myself. But I think it's a very interesting thing, because I'm interested in the relationship between the self, you know, between I and other people. That's what the book is about. And shame is a way of having the other inside of yourself, you know. And if you write, and if you have the other inside of yourself, you can't really write. You are not free, you know. So for me, it's very important to get rid of the other, to get rid of shame, to kind of have a zone of literary freedom where I can write whatever I want to, which I do. But the moment I get out of that zone, which is, you know, at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, it starts to fill me with shame. Thing I've been writing. It still does for, you know, 20 years. And when my first book, I was writing that, I sent 60 pages to my editor. It was the first 60 pages. And I was so ashamed by especially two things. I thought, this is the most stupid things that, you know. And he was saying, yeah, this is okay, but that was good, you know. That was good. That was really good. The thing I was ashamed of. That was because I was free and could allow me to do things. And the whole My Struggle project is about that. There's so many stupid things in there. There's so much banality. There's so much of those things that makes me very shameful. But that's also a very important part of it, you know. It makes it somehow alive because it's uncontrolled, because it's true. You know, it's not restricted, it's true.
Up in the gods.
John, I think earlier you had said there's something sort of postmodern about this writing, and I really touched something that I felt I recognized in reading these books, and something about the addictive quality about it. And one of the question I think I'd like to ask, or what I'd like you to comment on, is the sense that I had that there's something extraordinarily contemporary about the way the book takes you into stories, and the stories that subsequently I find myself recognizing in everyday life, and that, in a sense, that presence, the super importance, the meaning, that is always there. And I wondered if you might be able to comment on whether or not you have recognized that, because I think it's something that resonates for all of us in the way that we are interacting with our own stories now. More and more, I think I'm hearing examples of that, rather than a storyteller telling the story. In a sense, more and more of us are telling our own stories or recognizing that they're part of our life.
Yeah, I'm not sure how to reply to that.
That maybe experience is something that people, more and more people, think of in terms of stories, you know, not I'm having experience, but, oh, that my experience is this kind of story or that kind of story or this particular part of it is.
Yeah.
Maybe too many people with university degrees having their experiences.
But I try to basically to do the opposite. I don't know if I understand it right, but not to tell stories. But I feel the problem with the way we talk about the world and the way we see the world is through stories, is through news stories, which always is the same. So it's like everything is identical, you know. It's like there is those forms that repeats itself over and over and over again. And my book is the opposite of that. You know, it's the opposite of a media language, or it's the opposite of many stories. That's what I try to do, not tell stories. Mm.
Sorry, yes.
Thank you. Hi. I'm over here. In a strange way, because you've been so open with the world about your experiences, I feel compelled to ask you a question that I wouldn't dare ask people close to me in my life. and the question is about parenthood. I think through writing and recalling your memories, you've reflected a lot on the way you were parented, particularly by your father. And I wondered whether your books have in some way had an active role in informing how you've parented your four children.
Yeah. I think, but I think by writing about something, you can identify something and you can see it. And I don't see normally anything in my life. I'm completely blind, but I can see it when I write about it. And yes, I think I think that was very important for me. You know, my personal life, writing about having children, what you do and why you do it, and that's also why it's a lot of that in the book, because I felt that so much of what I was doing with my children was instinctively, you know, and it was like I was sometimes repeating my father, sometimes I was full of rage and doing all those kind of things which I didn't understand, but it was very strong in me, you know. So I think it helped me see that and at least I've been trying to change that, but that's, you know, that's the way I read books, and that's why I'm reading. It's to see things, and that's why I'm writing this, to see things and to understand things.
Yes, please.
Yeah, wonderful to be here, wonderful to be able to ask you a question. So here's a group of Finnish fans, and I have a question about titles, because your books have only numbers in Finnish, and as I have understood, they have numbers like My Struggle, number 1, 2, 3, and so on. And I was shocked when I entered this room, and there was these English books, and they have titles. So this A Man in Love is My Struggle too. So, I mean, when you wrote the books, they did not have titles in Norwegian language. And now the titles have been created. Is it just commercial purposes, or what do you think about these titles?
No, I think that has to do with the tradition in the country. I mean, what's possible and what you can do and cannot do. In Scandinavia, it was all mass struggle 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Germany was the first to who contacted me and asked if it was okay to have titles, and they did it partly because they couldn't call them Mein Kampf. That would be completely impossible. So there was a topic with titles there, and then I'm very happy for the titles in English, because I think they are so good and makes it into. I thought of the books as very different books, separate books, when I wrote them. It should be very different in tone, and I think the titles, I know, are reflecting that.
So did you invent them, or did you discuss them with your publisher?
I get a proposition, and I think I said, it's very good every time, so I like them. Yeah, I do.
Yeah. It's the kind of thing publishers are good at. I don't see why that's, problematic.
Yeah, but I'm thinking I wish I could write a book and call it A Man in Love. You know, that's how it is.
Yeah. Please, Manu.
Yes, once again, Carol. By the end of the sixth book, did you ever come the death of your father? And is there anything else that you want to say about him? Or was he really the most important person in your life, and you're okay with that, or you still have more to tell?
If I came to terms with my
yes,
father and my dad and my father,
yes.
Yeah.
Do you have more to tell about him?
Yeah, but I have. Yeah, I think I have with my father. The books are about, I try to understand him somehow, and to identify myself with him. When I was starting to write this book, I was 40. That was the age he was leaving the family. And then he died 14 years later. And he was very enigmatic to me. And when I was a kid, he was like almost inhuman. Yeah, he was the father. Yeah. And when I, beginning of this project, starting to write about him, I understood, well, he has the same kind of feeling as I have. He must have had, And I wanted to leave the family. I wanted to, start to drink. And I could understand him from that point of view. And then I could start to write about him. And that's interesting, because you say, to understand is to forgive. And yeah, it is like that. Not to any cost at all, but it is still like that. But then, when I published these books, I started to get letters from people who knew him, and who saw him and knew him when he was 10, knew him as a colleague, and told me stories I didn't know anything about, There was one teacher, his colleague, said he was traumatized. This was some childhood trauma I had, he was talking about all the time. I didn't know of that, And then I found his diaries, and I read his diaries, and I kind of... He's so much more than in the book. Of course, it's like that, but that's interesting, in any way. But what I'm writing about here is my relationship to him, He was much more than that. But I still have nightmares about him, and the nightmare is he's still alive and he has read the books.
We're going upstairs, first of all, and then please.
Hi there. I don't know if it's necessarily directly related to books or somewhat is. Do you have any tips or piece of advice for someone who will or is indeed fall in love with a Norwegian girl? This might be more towards your first book, but then again, A Man in Love could be more pertinent in that sense.
So you're asking me for advice for a man who fell in love with a Norwegian girl?
if you have any at all.
Sorry?
If you have any tips or advice, yeah, that'd be much appreciated.
No, I think by not being Norwegian, you will make it.
Please.
Yeah, hello. My own writing on a memoir has stalled for some time, and I just wondered, and the main reason it stalled is because I feel as I've been sort of, it's just such a painful process of self-flagellation and excavating the mine of me, that I was just choking on it. A friend of mine, when I started writing it, said to me, it's the things about yourself that burn your soul, that you're too ashamed to write about, even in your own diary at your own desk. Those are the things that people want to read when you're writing nonfiction, a memoir about your life. So with that said, I just wondered if you experienced that kind of pain in your writing, and if you ever got to a point where going back to fiction was just going to be a breath of fresh air and some kind of release from that prison. And if you did think about giving up, how did you get over that yourself?
Yeah, it's a good question. That was constant, difficult and painful thing. Not the childhood part, that was brilliant to write, but all the other parts. If you don't like yourself, you want to get away from yourself, you know. And I've always been doing that by reading. And then I become a writer. It was by writing, you know. I was could get away from myself. And to this project, I said, no, don't use literature as an escape. Use literature as a way to confront it. And it was. It was terrible, and I felt it like it. This is worthless, you know, because I'm worthless, then this is worthless. So I needed help, and I got help. I had, you know, my editor. He read everything and said, you know, this is brilliant. Go on, this is brilliant. Go on. And I had a friend. I read to him every day. I read to him 5,000 pages during 2 years. It's true, and he was just encouraging me and said, this is important, do it, this is important, this is not really about you, it's important. So I needed help to do it, and I could never have done it alone, you know. So that's how it is. And yeah, fiction would be a relief to go out there, but I couldn't, because that was the point. I shouldn't escape, you know. But somehow there is another element to this, and that is in writing. If you do it, there is an element of selflessness. There's an element of not being aware of yourself. And it could be, you know, very good to just to write, even if it's about painful things about yourself. So it's not very simple. It's a kind of complex thing. But yes, it was terrible. And a bit fun to write about some parts. That's how it was.
Lady here.
I'm going to lower the tone a little bit. I read all four of your books that have been published so far, sort of in tandem with my sister, and we discussed them endlessly in great detail and very seriously about all the serious issues there. But we kept coming back to the fact that it doesn't do much for Norwegian cuisine, your books. And this is a very simple question. What on earth is brown cheese?
Oh. Yeah,
it sounds horrible.
You can't explain what it is. I mean, it wouldn't make sense, but you have to taste it. It's kind of a goat milk cheese, which is sweet and brown.
Yeah,
and it's you grew up with it. So that's I you know, when I come to Norway, I buy it and take it back to Sweden. My children hates it, but I am attached to it. And Norwegian cuisine for me, food in this book there's no. But I love to describe it anyway, you know? It's a kind of a visual and thing. There is something there anyway, even if it, you know, I'm not interested in food in any way. I just want to, you know, get it over with.
You've got to go to Norway. I mean, I haven't read Hunger, but I've had brown cheese. And
yeah.
You were recommended to me. I knew nothing about you when I read your first book. And I must admit, I read it as a work of fiction, albeit intimate fiction. And given the amount of fiction that is inevitable in one's recollection of one's life, does it concern you if somebody reads it as a total work of fiction and not as a verite or as a recollection of your life?
No, I mean, that's... That's how it's read, I guess, by everybody. I mean, a little bit outside of my little circle, as a work of fiction. Anyway, I mean, there's no difference to read about
a fictional self and a real self, you know, in terms of what's going on there. And there is an element that's more maybe authentic or not so authentic, but still it is. I call these books in Norway novels. And that's, for me, it is kind of a non-fictional novel. So, yeah, I think that's how I want it to be read. I mean, yeah,
please.
There's a moment in A Man in Love where, I think it's A Man in Love, where your friend says to you that you told him or you confessed to him in the past that you had a relationship with a very young girl. I think it's when you're a teacher,
yeah,
and she's a student, and you're very thrown by it. You say, well, I never said that. And it creates this kind of moment of doubt of why he thinks you told him that.
Yeah.
But you also introduce your own moment of doubt where you question, could I have forgotten something like that?
Yeah.
And it's this very destabilizing moment in a novel, which is in a sequence of novels, which is a testimony to your recall, to your to the intricacies of your memory, where you raise in your reader's mind this enormous doubt about the capacity of your memory, and also maybe, you know, the sort of morality of you as a narrator, if you can you not only forget, maybe mislead. And I wondered why you did that, why you introduced this moment which casts so much doubt both on you as, I guess, an individual, if you're being, you know, in a kind of moral judgment way, but also just in your ability to remember things.
Yeah.
It's such a strange moment, and I just wondered if you could explain that a little bit.
Yeah, it's a very good question. The first time I've got that question, it's because that's a very, very important part in the novel, exactly at that point. And I think the only place where really something very important is at stake, and it is, you know, did it really happen, or can't I remember it? You know, all those kind of things, and that's a way of saying. First of all, it really happened. That was why I was writing it. It happened like that. He said this, and I couldn't understand it at all. And the second thing is that it says a lot of what this book is. It's about memory and recalling, and you can't trust your memory. You know, what I wanted to write, I didn't any research when I started. I didn't just wanted to write what's inside my head. You know, can you trust that? No, you can't. It changed, and I had a not very long time ago, the friend who I said was writing about me now, he wrote about an episode. It was a very crucial episode. It was a very difficult thing. And I remember it completely opposite. And in my version, I did, you know, something good. And in his version, I didn't. This is very oversimplifying it, but that was what it was. And I couldn't remember his version. No, it didn't happen that way, but I'm sure it did. And I kind of changed it in myself to make it more that I could accept it. I could accept it, you know. And that's the thing in the novel in that part. And then there is another thing that I wrote. My first novel was about that. A teacher, 26 years old, have a sexual relationship to his student when she's 13, you know. And with this book, I wanted to give a kind of a backstage to the other novels, so you can see where they come from, you know. And I'm just, and book four is a retelling of that story, but how it really was. But then in book six, again, I'm going back there again. And was this really, really, really the truth? Can I really tell the truth? Is it possible to do it, you know? I tried again. I tried four times to tell that story. I know what happened, and I'm absolutely sure, but still I want that insecurity to be there. There is several other occasions where I'm insecure, but this is very subjective version of a life, and it's full of, you know, it's shaped into something which is me, but which isn't true in that sense.
I'm afraid we're now going to have a last question, because although we could go on, we've got to let release Karlove at some stage. So please, madam, you're bringing the curtain down.
Thank you. You have a wonderful translator, Don Bartlett. How sure can you be that he is conveying your words and your intentions accurately?
Yeah, I'm very glad you asked that question, yeah. Because I don't read my translations. I trust my translators completely. Because you can't, a word mistake, that's not important. The only thing is that the flow is right and that the atmosphere in it's right, and you can't correct that. Either you got it or you don't have it. And then I got book five in the mail 2 weeks ago, and I thought, I'll just check, you know, just read a little bit. And I did, and I was sucked into it. And I was reading the half an hour, you know, like 30 pages, because it was like, yes, it was just reading about myself when I was 20. It was like my own soul was there. And I could only do that because it was in English. There's a little distance, you know. And that distance is literature, so you can see it. But that was amazing because it was so much me, so much my world, and so my writing. But it was in English, you know. That was strange. And that makes me absolutely sure that this is, you know, the best possible version of my book. It probably is. I mean, since there's so many people that are much better than my book, but that I can't.
Well, it's a very, very reassuring note for future purchasers to end on. We do have to end, I'm afraid. Thank you very much for your questions. Sorry to those of you who didn't get a chance. And I'm sure you'd all want me to thank him so much for coming and talking to us.
Thank you.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.